hard to know what to do with someone that's so desperately traumatized and grieving and sad and desperate and depressed and anxious. And she's young, you know, she was like 23, 24, something like this. And for no fault of hers, just the hell do you do with someone like me?
Yeah, it's not the brochure she originally got.
No, exactly. The brochure was the guy before.
Yeah, very in a short guy. Space of time, the brochure had changed. And,
exactly.
2010, where were you there?
2010, I was still in. I'd actually taken a posting to Sandhurst because I needed to get out of the reg, and I'd foreseen that I might be a good teacher.
Mm.
But no school was going to take just a war-torn lance jack from the reg. You can't just step into a classroom. So I spoke with my boss, and we decided that I started a open university course, and they thought that the time at Sandhurst would be less demanding of me, and that I was around other people that were educating themselves. So the officer cadets, they get educated as well while they're there, and that I would have time to study. So therefore, with the idea of leaving to become a teacher, because there was a soldiers to teacher transition project at that point. I was actually one of them, the early ones, and then it got stopped halfway through.
Really?
Yeah, which is why I then went on selection, because it's the only thing I've got left.
Mm. So what, tell me about the symptoms in Sandhurst.
That was migraines, cluster migraines, which are horrendous. They are really unpleasant. That's a migraine that lasts for 3 days, and then you get a couple of days rest, and then it will come back again. And I probably got one of them at least once every month. And that is a migraine.
Oh, cluster. Sorry, so you have 3 days, then nothing for a few days, and it comes back again, and that's the cluster.
Yeah. Yeah.
The return of it.
Yeah.
Right, I'm with you. Okay.
And then, yeah, and they just don't stop. So that was draining. And I was also sweating uncontrollably in all situations, all of the time. In bed, on my own, in public, in a group, to anything, I was just dripping with sweat. And that's
what way? Armpits, hands?
Armpits, hands, face. Everything was just dripping with sweat.
And how was that impacting your life?
It's embarrassing.
Yeah.
And so it made me anxious. And so I was already probably anxious and depressed. But then I had a physical symptom that could be seen by others, which is embarrassing, which made me more anxious. So I began to spiral, and I'm grieving as well, and blah, blah, blah. All of this is happening, and there's no pills for that. I tried antidepressants. I tried talking therapies. For me, it didn't do much good.
Within the military kind of health system, I suppose, you know, were you going to military?
Yeah.
The med center, and then getting referred on from there.
Yeah.
So, and was that supportive? Was it fit for purpose for you?
No, not for me.
I think one of the big factors which shocked me, but then didn't shock me, was the fact that they'd pinned PTSD on you.
Mm-hmm.
When to you it was quite obviously not.
Yeah. I mean, the early stages, the first week of doing the one-to-one work with a psychiatrist in my room, they do a full rewind back to your childhood, and then they start sort of walking forward in slow time, trying to pick up things that they can hang a tag on. So, you know, it was very, very easy for them to say, oh, you were ex-military, oh, you've been in Afghanistan and Iraq and all these places, oh, you've been a close protection operator in Afghanistan. You've clearly seen a lot of, you know, you've been in a lot of situations. You clearly have PTSD. It's the most logical answer. And I'm thinking to myself, well, I don't fundamentally agree with that whatsoever. The time I had in the army was nothing but a positive time. I would go back to Afghanistan in a heartbeat. I really, really thrived in that environment, really thrived in it. What they were telling me to them sounded logical, and it sounded like 1,001 other stories that I'd heard of somebody who'd left the military, you know, and walked in the same path that I've been, and been just tarred with the same PTSD brush as everyone else. And I fundamentally didn't agree with that. I don't think that was the case at all.
You did a lot of, you're an intelligent man. and you are astute and you research and you did this in the, I suppose, your own self-recovery, self-compassion. I don't think it was self-medication.
No.
But it was certainly, you were doing things to try and make the situation better. You were on the rise again.
Yeah. I mean, I looked at myself a couple of times and I could see what was happening to me. The medication that they had me on for the best part of a year now, I was beginning to notice little strange quirks and little strange neuroses in my behaviour. My short-term memory was being impacted. I was also going to mention it before we came on here. Sometimes I can be holding a conversation, a subject that I know all about, know back to front, I know all my P's and Q's, and I'll be telling you about it, quite the thing, and suddenly I'll lose my train of thought, and it'll take me 5-10 seconds to rewind and go, right, what was I saying? And to get myself back on track. And I noticed that happening a lot in the early state, like I said, 6 months into this heavily prescribed sort of stint of recovery. You know, there was the antipsychotic medication, there was antidepressants, there was sleeping tablets, there was anti-anxiety medication. They tried me on a bunch of things. Problem is, I'm quite tolerant to a lot of medication, so things would work for maybe a week and then they wouldn't, and I'd raise a complaint about it and they'd try and change it. So they bounced me about off of 10 plus medications, and all have left their little lasting effect on me to a greater or lesser extent. Some of them haven't, but and I noticed that in the first few sort of 6 to 12 months. So I was conscious that I didn't want to take these anymore. They weren't doing what I thought they should have been doing. I thought if I have a clear head and a clear perspective rather than a sort of, you know, just that glass effect over my eyes, if I had a clear perspective, I can figure out what's happened, why it happened, what now, where now, and try and take baby steps forward. But I wanted to do it clear-minded, or not clear-minded, but I needed to get all the medication that I'd been recommended and told that would help. I had to get that out of my system and start it from afresh. And if it meant that coming off the medication made me feel worse, then so be it. That was something I was warned about. You know, you come off all these little things that you've been reliant on for the best part of a year, your body's going to have a negative reaction. And to be honest, I was happy to endure it regardless what the side effects were, because the side effects that I was seeing from them, it wasn't positive by any stretch of the imagination.
And what were you feeling now? Was you still sweating? Had things changed? How would your nervous system, how was that working? How was you physically? You mentioned the physical side of things. What was going on?
Yeah, I realised I needed help. And a few things happened all in a very short period of time. One is that a dear friend of mine actually got me, invited me to his house and sat me down in his kitchen. And he said, I've bought you this. And it was, at that time, it was called a legal high, which was, it was basically ecstasy, but with one molecule changed so that it was legal. They very quickly made it illegal again, but we managed to get one each. And he's very good at sitting and listening and, just listening. So we had this, what would be MDMA, essentially. And it helped a great, great deal. It helped me, you know, I'd be carrying my Bergen around, a Bergen of trauma on my back. And I was just carrying it around for no real reason. And so those few hours in that kitchen with MDMA, or it wasn't MDMA, but something very...
It turned off the amygdala. It turned off fight flight, did it, in the brain?
Yeah.
It allowed you to speak.
Yeah, it allowed me to speak. It just... I was introduced to compassion. I was introduced to forgiveness. And I was introduced to gratitude. They're like the real three things that I took from that. And that I didn't need to carry this stuff around with me all the time. And that, what happened there after that, the way that I see it happened is that I actually had this spiritual awakening pretty soon after that. It kind of cracked everything open. It didn't change my symptoms, didn't heal my symptoms in any way. So half of me was having this really intense spiritual experience where I was seeing all sorts of weird things. But then the other half of me in my physical body, I was being tormented by tension and trauma. And so I was still sweating and I was still embarrassed and therefore I was anxious.
Mm-hmm.
So yet again, another period of this duality, this conflict I was experiencing with myself. And so I realized that I needed to look at my body. I needed to look at what was going on in my body. And so a guy at JP Morgan, a colleague of mine, really lovely guy, he suggested that I should try Tai Chi. But I was still in para reg mode when he suggested that. And I was like, no. Like, I'll fight people.
Yeah, I'll box, but I'm not doing Tai Chi.
Yeah, I'll bite. And I was boxing at that point. I'll box and I'll beat people up. It'll make me feel better. But no, I'm not just mincing around, waving my hands. Okay, well, I thought I'd offer it. But anyway, so I went home that night and I looked it up on YouTube anyway. And I did a 4-hour class on YouTube of Tai Chi in my front room in my flat.
Oh, really?
And I had a profound experience. I was not focused on, I didn't feel tension in my body. I didn't feel that I had a frantic mind. I was just focused on moving my body in a way that that man told me to in the video. I had 4 hours of peace, which I hadn't had for years.
A physical meditation.
Yeah, exactly. And then the next night I did the same thing. I did the same 4 hours again, and I did it again, and I did it again. And then my son bought me a DVD. So I did the DVD, and then I built up the sort of balls to go to an actual class, because again, I was still kind of, oh, I'm a paratrooper. I don't want to be seen at a Tai Chi class. But I went and I had an amazing time, and I was finding real, genuine peace in these hours. Outside of those hours, all bets were off.
Mm.
But I knew it was important. And so I was really enjoying this practice. But then also I came to be aware, actually, a friend of mine, another friend who's an American, she then told me about this thing called ayahuasca.
How long was you there? Did you do it once? Did you do it 5 times? What was the process of that trip in the Amazon?
Yeah, so it's about, there was about 15 ceremonies, something like that. I mean, traditionally, I use that in the kind of loosest sense of the word, but traditionally in a tribal setting in the Amazon, a ayahuasca ceremony is led by a shaman, and it's in a hut called a maloka, which is a circular hut, maybe 20 meters wide, and people drink a teacup or a small glass full of the ayahuasca brew, and then lay down on a mattress. And In nearly all circumstances, there's a shaman leading the ceremony, and he and maybe one or two others would sing these songs called Icaros, and they're traditional tribal songs. And they're really amazingly powerful. These guys can belt out tunes, but they're in a completely incomprehensible language in ways that are nothing like our own conception of, music. So it was very strange, very weird, but you'd feel under the sense of ayahuasca that you could feel the music of these Icaros just reverberating through you. So, sometimes they would, sing really, really close to you within like 2 feet. And so you can imagine getting serenaded by, Pavarotti or an opera singer, you take that and times it by 10, it just goes straight through you as this wall of sound. And if you combine that with the intense feelings of psychedelia and the visionary aspect, which is really, really otherworldly, and you're in a jungle and you can just hear the chirps and rasps and a million different insects, all the natural jungle wildlife outside of the Maloka, it's overwhelming. It's literally overwhelming. It's so overwhelming that a part and a known and completely wholly acknowledged part of the ayahuasca ceremony is to purge, also to puke. So, you drink it after 30 minutes, it would settle in your stomach. The visions would come on really, really strong. You get a sense inevitably of, oh my God, what have I done now? Am I coming back? That usual, fear. And then most people, I'd say kind of 9 out of 10, me included, you'd have a bucket there and then you puke into the bucket. And then after that, then after the waves of nausea would go away, then you'd settle back into it, and it'd be a lot more comforting, and the visions would calm down, and it would be a lot less hectic.